Good morning, everyone. Okay, in today's CME podcast, Selected Updates in Primary Care for the OBGYN, Episode 1, we will discuss mechanical low back pain, asthma, acute coronary syndrome, and headache. Dr. Eric Wyckoff is producer and contributor. Mr. Bill Scott is technical advisor. Mrs. Sarah Solowski is administrative coordinator. Your host and founder, Robert S. Egerman, MD, FACOG, is boarded in obstetrics and gynecology, maternal fetal medicine, and internal medicine. He is currently interim chief of maternal fetal medicine at the University of Florida, Gainesville campus, professor of obstetrics and gynecology, maternal fetal medicine, professor of medicine, general internal medicine. Today's invited guest speaker, Dr. Gerard Kua, grew up in Palm Beach Gardens, Florida. He completed his undergraduate training at the University of Florida, where he majored in English and graduated with honors. He went to medical school at the University of Florida College of Medicine, graduating in 2015. His postgraduate training has included an internship in internal medicine at the University of Florida in 2016. And in 2019, he will be completing his residency in family medicine at the University of South Florida. Dr. Kua has special interests in women's health, obstetrics and gynecology. He has multiple publications in both internal medicine and obstetrics and gynecology. One of his most recent publications was published in the Journal of Maternal Fetal and Neonatal Medicine entitled Efficacy of the VBAC Calculator at the University of Florida. With co-authors Dr. Egerman, Dr. Wyckoff, and Dr. Gibson at the University of Florida Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology. He is well known by our faculty and has left a favorable impression on most. Dr. Kua, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
The next voice you will hear will be the voice of Dr. Robert Egerman.
Good morning again.
It's good,
good to have you back in Gainesville.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And we have a couple of topics today all related to primary care, but there's a wrench thrown in here. All of these patients happen to be pregnant. And let's tee off with the first case.
Okay.
And the first case I want to get your thoughts on, a 29-year-old mulliparous patient at 15 weeks gestation presents to the clinic low back pain for the past week. She describes the pain as aching and interfering with her daily activities. You see a lot of back pain in pregnancy. Maybe just give us an overview of what to think about when it comes to back pain in pregnancy.
Sure. So as you guys are probably all well aware, low back pain is pretty common, both in the general population and in pregnancy. About 80% of adults in their life, at least at one point, will have an acute episode of low back pain. And in pregnancy, it's reported about a 60% occurrence rate, mostly in the second half of pregnancy. And that's usually from some well-known mechanical factors that happen, such as increased weight, changes in the laxity of their joints, and then also changes in actually their posture as their pregnancy progresses. So while the vast majority of etiologies are mostly benign, there are also some other things you have to rule out when you're talking about low back pain.
And maybe let's just run through a differential diagnosis of what to be thinking about in somebody who's presenting with low back pain at 15 weeks.
Okay, sure. So like I said, a lot of the majority of things will be things that are mostly benign, like lumbosacral strain, but you could also have disc pathologies like herniated disc, slip discs, things like that. But the main things you definitely want to rule out are things like fractures, infections, of course, malignancy, and also Cauda equina syndrome. So a lot of that you can get just from talking to the patient about their history. So for fractures, you want to make sure they haven't sustained any significant trauma, they haven't reported any contusions or abrasions on their back. And also another thing to think about would be if they're on any prolonged corticosteroids, because that can also predispose them to more fractures. for infections. You want to make sure they haven't had any recent spinal procedures, particularly within the last 12 months. Make sure they're not IV drug users, and then also they don't have any risk factors for like immune suppression or anything like that. For malignancy, it would be things like history of malignancy, obviously, particularly ones that are known to metastasize to bone, such as breast or lung or renal or thyroid cancers. And then for Cauda-Quina syndrome, you're always going to be looking out for any neurological deficits, like any saddle anesthesia, bowel or bladder incontinence, or any weakness or motor or sensory loss.
The physical exam is almost a lost art, but are there some aspects of the physical exam which you'd be paying particular attention to in evaluating the patient with back pain?
Sure. So the physical exam itself is pretty straightforward. So we always start with the inspection. We kind of look at their lower back, looking for any deformities or any bruises or any rashes. And you can actually have the patient kind of point to where they feel the pain the most. Then afterwards, you'd start by palpating their spinous processes, make sure there's no point tenderness in any parts of their spine. And then you move on to the paraspinous muscle groups, just to make sure that you don't elicit any spasm or anything like that. That could point you to maybe more of a musculoskeletal cause. Afterwards, you would do range of motion testing by making them kind of lean forward, check their flexibility, also extend their spine to see if you can elicit any pain from spinal extension, which would make you more suspicious for like spinal stenosis, things like that. Afterwards, you would move down to the hip, and you could kind of do a roll on their legs just to make sure you can differentiate if it's coming from their back or if it's hip pathology. And also, there's other tests like the Faber test, where you can kind of make a figure four with their legs, kind of push on the opposite knee and hip to see if you can elicit pain, because if you can, then it's probably more sacroiliac pain other than lumbar lower back pain. And then if they report any radicular symptoms, like shooting pains, you can do the straight leg raise test, where you have them lay on their back, and then you raise the affected leg while having them dorsiflex their foot. And if you can elicit the same kind of pain, then at about 30 to 70 degrees of flexion, then it's probably more radicular pain. And then based on where they're feeling the pain, you can kind of tell which dermatome is responsible. So like L4 would be like shooting to their knees or their quadriceps. L5 would be more their anterior tibia, and then S1 would be like kind of their calves, for example.
And a lot of times we can't sort this out with physical exam, so we look to imaging for answers. What is the role of imaging in back pain?
So for imaging, a lot of societies are actually in agreement with mechanical low back pain in terms of advocating for more judicious use of imaging. So a lot of societies that I've listed here, including the American College of Radiology, their appropriateness criteria that they use. For mechanical low back pain, they recommend waiting at least 6 weeks of conservative therapy before initiating any imaging, because it hasn't really been shown to have any benefit in the short term.
And this is the Choosing Wisely campaign as
yes,
well, just recommending no imaging in these circumstances. Well, assuming this is mechanical low back pain, what kind of therapeutic options do we have?
Sure. So the AAFP actually published an update to the kind of looked at the evidence for low back pain. It was back in October 2018, so it was a pretty recent update. So in terms of medications that we can use, acetaminophen is still the best, which has the best safety profile in pregnancy. So usual dosing would be about 650 every 4 to 6 hours. The next thing would be NSAIDs, which you can't really use in pregnancy, but they do have some effectiveness for short-term pain relief in patients without radicular symptoms. And so that would be like ibuprofen and naproxen, which you can use. Going down the list, muscle relaxants are also an option, because they do have moderate quality evidence that supports their use in the short term. But in patients, you always have to watch out, because that can make people very lightheaded, dizzy, and also be very sedating, so not a lot of people can tolerate them. For things like topical lidocaine and steroids, those have not been shown to be more effective than placebo. And so things like that probably wouldn't have that much benefit patients. And moving further down on the list, anticonvulsants you can't really use in pregnancy because of their teratogenicity, but that is also an option in the non-pregnant patient. And then for antidepressants, actually, there's one medication that's been shown to treat not just depression, but also like chronic pain, which is duloxetine. It's also called Cymbalta. So we use that a lot for patients who have low back pain, but also comorbid depression. But the other antidepressants, don't have really any evidence that they're more effective than placebo. And then probably one of the things furthest down on the list would be opioids, would be like the tramadol and the Percocet, which do have some short-term effectiveness, but they do have significant side effects and risks for abuse and diversion, things like that. So not a lot of people use them.
Certainly. And if these measures don't work, what other options do you have?
Sure. So for what we call complementary therapies and things like that, still the best thing would be maintaining mobility and keeping physically active. So things like yoga actually have very strong evidence that they are effective in the short term for these kinds of patients. Also physical therapy and an exercise program. And then still with the update that the AAFP published, osteopathic manipulation, acupuncture, TENS units, they still have pretty mixed evidence, but they're kind of saying that if patients who have access to this, if they're interested in it, they tend not to have that much evidence for harm. So if they're interested and they want to try it, it's not unreasonable for them to try it. And then things like cognitive behavioral therapy, there's some evidence for like biofeedback and things like that that patients are willing to try. People use that generally more as an adjunct to an already established kind of prep for them. So if they do want to do that, weeks for it to become effective. And then lower down would be things like injections and surgery, which if you're at that point, then you probably already have a specialist involved, already have imaging and things like that ordered. So.
Yeah, that was a very good summary. So just some take-home messages. We want to make sure we're not dealing with chronic Quinn's syndrome. We have a couple of options for mechanical low back pain in terms of therapy, the acetaminophen, perhaps even a muscle relaxant, and most importantly, don't do imaging, but get them moving into physical therapy. That is excellent.
Okay, great.
All right. Well, it looks like the next case here is that of a 32. Well, I'll let you present the case
okay,
to me.
Sure. All right. Asthma. Okay, so the next topic would be asthma. So we have a 35-year-old female, P2012 at 32 weeks. She's here for a 4-hour history of not being able to catch her breath. So she has an incessant cough, and she's been complaining that it's hard for her to breathe. So no recent history of asthma, but she did say at one time that when she was in college, she was given an inhaler. More recently, a few weeks ago, she started having a chest cold that she thinks her 5-year-old gave to her because he's been in daycare. Her past history is just significant for some stage 2 obesity, and the only medication she really takes is prenatal vitamins. So for a patient who comes in with acute shortness of breath, kind of what kind of things would you be thinking about in terms of your differential?
Well, I would initially keep the differential broad. This is a patient of 32 weeks coming in who's not able to catch her breath. Asthma is certainly on that differential. Also as well would be congestive failure. Could this be cardiac wheezing? Pulmonary embolism is a possibility as well. Again, I would feel more comfortable if she had a more recent history of asthma in this situation, which she doesn't, but we're going to keep that on the differential. Pneumonia is possible, pneumothorax effusion and malignancy are considerations, and we should be able to rule those out fairly quickly on the physical exam. If this person had sort of a chronic asthma that wasn't being able to be controlled very easily, considerations would be for paradoxical vocal cord dysfunction, tracheomalacia. A lot of times that can either be congenital or even acquired. Again, I wouldn't anticipate an acute presentation of that. Upper airway obstruction, we don't know when she ate last or what she took in. COPD is a possibility. Bronchiectasis, again, most of those patients will have had a history of asthma or infection or even cases of cystic fibrosis or alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency. But going on down, we have a few more things to consider. Sarcoidosis, which could present in such a way. Allergic bronchopulmonary aspergillosis and eosinophilic granulomatosis with polyangiitis. Are diseases that usually are associated with asthma and should remain on our differential should this patient be difficult to treat.
Okay, so kind of going from that wide differential down to what we know as asthma, so what kind of things would you be asking about making sure that you know in a patient who is having an asthma exacerbation right now?
The history is very important. There are two types of asthma, that which is intermittent and that which is persistent. persistent asthma is divided into mild, moderate, and severe, depending on the frequency of attacks during the day or during the week. What I'd want to know is past history regarding steroid use, visits to the emergency room, or admissions to the hospital within the past year. Are there any comorbidities that go along with asthma, such as GERD, sinusitis, rhinitis, obstructive sleep apnea, or obesity? Also, what's worked for her in the past? She was on albuterol during college, but that's been many years ago. But it is helpful to know what's used, and to see if there's any recent triggers, like dust mites or cockroaches or mold around the house, which is ever so prevalent, and pet dander. And in this case, it does sound like there was a recent rhinovirus or respiratory virus exposure not too long ago.
Okay. All right. So now in terms of physical exam, what kind of things would you be making sure that you're noting when you see the patient?
The most obvious thing to me is to see if the patient can converse. Is she able to talk to me comfortably? And that probably gives me the most information. Also, being aware of if she's using accessory muscles of respiration, looking at the vital signs, particularly the oxygen saturation, looking her over to see if she has any atopic issues such as dermatitis, nasal swelling, or drainage, again, a clue that this has been going on for a while as asthma, listening to the lung exam, listening for wheezes, listening for crackles posteriorly, and crackles can be nonspecific. They can represent pulmonary fibrosis, or they can represent fluid, and seeing if there's any decreased breath sounds in any of the lung fields. If there is decreased breath sounds, seeing if there's dullness. If we're uncertain of our diagnosis, we're going to be moving ahead with some additional studies. Listening to the heart, atrial fibrillation can present in such manner. And finally, seeing if there's any pulmonary edema, or rather, pedal edema.
So in terms of like, after you've seen the patient, what kind of lab tests or imaging would you want to get for her?
Most immediate would be an FEV1, which is a surrogate, would be the peak expiratory flow rate, which should be around 400 or 500 liters per minute. Many times we ask the patient to have one of these at home, but inevitably they aren't able to afford one. But this can be obtained in the emergency room, and if we're under 200 liters per minute, we're in trouble. Also getting a CBC with differential, with CMP, and if there's ambiguity in the diagnosis, of chest x-ray. 12-lead EKG can be useful too if there's some suggestion of arrhythmia. We mentioned pulmonary embolism on the initial differential, and not everybody needs to be run through a helical CT if we're thinking about pulmonary embolism. This patient is 32 weeks, that has to be on the differential. Some recent information saying that the D-dimer and used with a scoring criteria such as the Geneva criteria can be very useful in sorting out those who are at high risk in pregnancy for having a pulmonary embolism and those who are low risk and no further testing needs to be done. In the appropriate setting, rapid flu testing, viral PCR, and of course, 32 weeks, fetal monitoring.
Okay. So let's say those labs are all cooking and the imaging is being processed. What kind of things can you do immediately now to help her get breathing better?
Given that she is pregnant, keeping her O2 saturation at 95% or above, that could be with oxygen face mask, administering a beta agonist, typically albuterol, 2.5 to 5 milligrams every 20 minutes, inhaled up to 3 doses. Ipratropium is a drug that we've used in the past very frequently for COPD. 500 micrograms of that in a nebulized fashion can be very helpful. And administering steroids very early on, either oral or IV. If she's able to take oral, I think most people would administer 60 milligrams of prednisone to start with. And incidentally, continue that for the next 5 days if we determine this is an acute asthma exacerbation. If the first three medications don't work, we can give magnesium sulfate, which the obstetricians are very familiar with, 2 grams over 20 minutes. And this has been demonstrably helpful in keeping people out of the hospital and enable them for discharge. And finally, IV fluids with normal saline until this diagnosis has been sorted out.
Okay. So let's say you do all of those things for her and she's starting to breathe better. he's ready to leave the emergency department. What kind of long-term therapies are available for her to prevent her from getting any more flares?
The foundation of long-term therapy are inhaled glucocorticoids for most patients, and depending on the severity of asthma, eclomethazone, 80 micrograms, given 1 to 2 times a day, 1 to 2 puffs 2 times a day, and increasing the dose as needed. Budesonide is another one that we use, and fluticasone, we use both of those quite frequently. If those do not control the asthma, a long-acting beta agonist such as salmeterol or formoterol can be used. They're combinations of inhaled glucocorticoids and long-acting beta agonists, which are extremely helpful, such as budesonide and formoterol. If that doesn't work, go into a leukotriene inhibitor such as montelukast, 10 milligrams orally a day. And finally, if needed, a long-acting anticholinergic such as tiotropium, 1.25 micrograms inhaled BID. If we're not making much progress with this, we can go to the biologic agents, and usually at that point we are in the realm of the pulmonary medicine physician.
Okay, so for one last little tidbit about asthma, say this patient was a smoker and she was interested in quitting smoking, what kind of options would she have for smoking cessation?
During pregnancy, smoking is very bad, both obviously in a patient with asthma and one who doesn't have asthma. Offering nicotine patches, 21 milligrams per day to start with, or nicotine gum, 2 to 4 milligram doses, and up to 24 doses a day, depending on her nicotine need. I've always thought that getting somebody to quit smoking is highly dependent on treating their depression and their anxiety. And bupropion has been shown to be helpful in pregnancy, 150 milligrams BID. We tend to start with 150 milligrams for the first couple of days. This is contraindicated in somebody with a seizure disorder, and if one goes off the bupropion, we typically taper that off.
Okay, so that's good. So a little overview of asthma. Some things to keep in mind are things like, it's definitely good to get a thorough history of the patient's asthma, because that's actually how we grade the severity of it. It influences how we do the step-up therapy based on what they're already on and how severe their asthma is. And in terms of immediate things that you can do during an asthma exacerbation, it's good to have all of those tools that you have, but also not a lot of people are aware about the magnesium that you can use to help with that if it's refractory. And a lot of people aren't aware that you have to infuse it over 20 minutes. A lot of the times people infuse it over like an hour and stuff, but it has to be more of a rapid infusion. And then in terms of like the long-term therapy and stuff, I'm not sure if you guys have it in your clinic, but we actually have like a lot of samples of the Lava Llamas and things like that. So they can be pretty expensive, so you may be able to get it just in your clinic, because we have a lot of those that we can give to our patients who are underinsured or have severe asthma. So
Would be very helpful as well, enabling them to get these medications to the clinic or a $4 drug program. Well, our next case involves acute coronary syndrome. This is a 39-year-old primiparous patient at 8 weeks gestation who presents to the emergency room with 30 minutes of central chest pain that occurred after an episode of vomiting. The pain is pressure-like and radiates down both arms and associated with nausea. Past history is significant for uncontrolled type 2 diabetes and a 20-pack-year smoking history. Can you take us through just a brief assessment of what this differential looks like?
Okay, sure. So with anybody with like undifferentiated chest pain that comes to the ER, the differential is always very broad. So you usually do it in terms of kind of systems-based. So cardiac would be what we're talking about, ACS, pericarditis, aortic dissection, even if you're thinking about that. Pulmonary would be PE, pneumothorax, pneumonia. She has a history of smoking, she may have COPD, so she could be in an exacerbation of that. Asthma exacerbation, if she has history of asthma. GI would be things like GERD, esophagitis, peptic ulcer disease, musculoskeletal, which is more common, like costochondritis. Any history of trauma or rib fractures could also give her chest pain. And then things like dermatological things to think about, like cellulitis or even zoster. And psychiatric too, like anxiety or panic attacks, and substance abuse as well. So pretty broad, but you have to be able to kind of narrow it pretty quickly through other means to be able to manage patients pretty efficiently.
And in this factor, and then, excuse me, in this setting, the risk factors for coronary disease in this woman?
Sure. So for her, it would be older age. She is 39 years old. Other things like history of hypertension, diabetes, smoking, obesity, hyperlipidemia, pretty similar to the general population when you're thinking about coronary syndrome, but things more specific to pregnancy would be like things like history of preeclampsia in the past, thrombophilia, history of any thrombosis or antiphospholipid syndromes, and then also, like I mentioned before, drug use, like cocaine use. So definitely things to think about when you're considering coronary syndrome.
And we really should consider the long-term effects of preeclampsia on folks' coronary disease. Certainly that relationship, as you pointed out, has been known. Well, right out of the box, what are we going to do with the patient?
Yeah, so even before seeing the patient, there are some labs and tests that you're definitely going to want to get. So, of course, vital signs, an EKG, placing them on telemetry. Get like a CBC, a BNP, like basic labs, and then, of course, draw troponin level. For things like BNP and the D-dimer, I'd probably hold off on those till I see the patient first because you kind of want to know a little bit more about if they have any history of a heart failure or anything like that, and if you're more suspicious for a DVT or a PE. For imaging, you're going to want to get a chest X-ray, and then while those are in the computer and ordered, you want to go see the patient and do a focused history and physical, kind of see which of the differential you're kind of more in the going in the direction of.
And then we're going to be administering some medication fairly rapidly in this patient. What would we be doing?
So after you see her, listen to her heart and lungs, do a physical exam, and you're still suspicious for acute coronary syndrome, or if her initial troponin is elevated, or if she has any suspicious EKG findings, they do recommend doing a full dose aspirin, which is 324 milligrams one time. You can also, like aspirin is generally safe in pregnancy because we do use low dose aspirin in pregnancy as well.
Certainly.
Other things like statins and ACE inhibitors, which would be usually recommended for patients with acute coronary syndrome. Can't really use in pregnancy because they're contraindicated, but they do have the dosing for that. So for statins, it would be high intensity dosing, and then for the ACE inhibitors, you can start at a lower dose and titrate up. Things like nitrates, if you can administer that for patients, because those are generally well tolerated, but you just have to make sure you avoid hypotension with that. And it comes in a lot of different preparations. So there's tablets, sprays, patches and ointments. People generally prefer ointments and patches because if they do get hypotensive, you can quickly remove them. And then moving forward with other things like beta blockers, those are generally well tolerated in pregnancy, so you can use those to decrease the cardiac workload. If they do have suspicion for a STEMI or NSTEMI, you put them on a heparin drip while you're bridging them to percutaneous coronary intervention. So there's always like a heparin drip protocol, but the loading dose and the maintenance doses are over there. And then if you're at the point where you're considering like fibrinolytic therapy and stenting, those would probably be more used in conjunction with the cardiologist and also the high-risk or maternal fetal medicine specialist.
Just as we've talked about stratifying for pulmonary embolism, what can be used to stratify somebody for acute coronary syndrome?
So in terms of that, so there are a lot of like calculators that are being developed very recently, so it's a big area of interest to be able to identify low-risk patients and then stratify them so that you can actually be discharged from the hospital. They don't have to stay overnight for the usual overnight observation, trending their troponins and things like that. So one of the scores that was recently developed is something called the HART score. That stands for history, EKG, age, risk factors, and troponin levels. So you basically plug all the components into the calculator, and based on the study that they performed back in 2008, if they have a score of 0 to 3, they're actually recommend a safe discharge home. Has a 98% negative predictive value for what they were studying was major adverse coronary, acute coronary events in 6 weeks. So anything like coming back to the hospital with acute coronary syndrome, needing a percutaneous coronary intervention, or even needing CABG. They followed those patients over 6 weeks and found that none of the patients they studied that went home actually ended up having to come back to the hospital for any of those interventions. So it was originally developed in 2008, but they did a study at Wake Forest in 2015, where they took the score and actually turned it into something called an accelerated diagnostic protocol. So it actually, they added on a second troponin value at 3 hours. So if they had 2 negative troponin values and their heart score was 0 to 3, they were actually able to send them home. And they found that it decreased the length of stay by about 12 hours, decreased unnecessary testing by about 12%, and then increased their discharge rates. And so this is just one of the things that, one of the areas of interest that a lot of emergency departments and primary care are interested in developing these calculators. And none of them have specifically studied like a pregnant population or anything. So all of these were just in the general population. But if there's growing interest in like an obstetric version of this calculator, maybe something that could be developed in the future.
I think that's a very good point. I think the teaching point in this case is that she is at 8 weeks. She's coming in with chest pain. She has all the risk factors for coronary disease. We start this stuff sort of out of the box, both the diagnostic approach and the therapeutic approach with aspirin nitrates, and certainly giving her the 25 IV metoprolol as recommended. Well, I think that takes us to our last case here in this primary care session. And I would just say that headaches in primary care are incredibly frequent, and headaches in pregnancy are incredibly frequent.
Yeah.
Can you?
Sure. So here's the last case for the day. So, 39-year-old female, P1001, 2 weeks postpartum from a spontaneous vaginal delivery at term, comes in with a 6-hour history of this bilateral frontal incessant headache. And during her pregnancy, her prenatal and intrapartum course was unremarkable. She does have a history of tension headaches, which she gets a few times a week, but this is kind of different from that, she says. She hasn't thrown up or anything, and she's not affected by light or sound, but she doesn't feel well, she says. And then other than vitamins, she doesn't really take any medications. So just as you have like red flag symptoms for low back pain, there's also some red flag symptoms for headaches that you want to make sure that you rule out. So we could kind of briefly go over those as well.
Absolutely. The mnemonic for red flags for headaches is SNOOC. And SNOOC stands for systemic, including fever. Pregnancy is in that category. And HIV. Neurologic dysfunction, meaning fusion, papilledema, or focal neurologic effects. O, the first O, for onset greater than 40 years, but some people would say even, or rather than 50, onset greater than 50 years, but some people would argue 40 years. Other, including trauma, headache with Valsalva, or headache awakening from sleep. And finally, the last part of that mnemonic, P, for SNOOP, is previous headache with a change or a progression in that headache.
All right, so if you're able to rule out a lot of the red flag symptoms, you're still left with a constellation of headache syndromes and things like that. So what else would be in the differential diagnosis for a headache?
We really have a large differential here for headache. And The first thing would be, very commonly, would be migraine or tension headaches. Many times there's a combination of those. There's some overlap there. The migraines classically are unilateral, the throbbing associated with pain with light or sound. Tension headache is more global across the head. Cluster headache is more unilateral and having a severe onset. Rebound headache, if a patient has been on medication and has abruptly stopped that. Getting into this patient a little bit, she is status post delivery. Dural puncture headache it's a little bit late, 2 weeks later, but that's still possibly on the differential. Preeclampsia, really, in any situation concerning pregnancy, should be at the top of the list. Benign intracranial hypertension occurs in patients with pregnancy, as well as reversible posterior encephalopathy syndrome, and that would go along with preeclampsia. There's a few more to be considered during this postpartum period. Vertebral or carotid dissection, where there is a clot in either the vertebral or carotid arteries. intracranial hemorrhage from either an AV malformation or an aneurysm with good rupture postpartum or cerebral venous thrombosis. Again, all of these have occurred in pregnancy. For the non-pregnant patient, these are considerations as well.
Okay. All right. And then, so usually when you see somebody in the ER for headaches, they always have some kind of imaging already done, so like a CT scan or an MRI of the brain. But kind of before you jump into imaging, what kind of things would you get kind of pre-imaging for this patient?
I think you did hit the nail on the head. The imaging is many times central, although many societies recommend not doing imaging in many times. First thing I look at is the patient's alertness. Is she able to speak coherently? Also, wanting to know what her vital signs are and what her oxygen saturation is. If the patient's hypoxemic, that could be a reason for a headache as well. Doing a quick cranial nerve assessment, looking at global strength and sensation, and is she able to move? Essentially seeing if there is a focal neurologic exam. The other thing I would be looking for in this patient, and we don't know whether she is presenting febrile or not, but if there's a potential source of infection, ears, neck, breasts, abdomen, and perineum. The ophthalmologic examination can be challenging for many people, but really, with a little practice, we're looking essentially at the optic disc to see if there is pressure, increased pressure within the head, and what we're looking for is blunting of the optic disc and decreased vessel visualization within the optic disc. Looking for a rash, again, suggesting that there may be an infection. The CBC is helpful to me. Again, if the patient has a low hemoglobin, that could be an explanation for the headache. CMT is always useful, testing for renal and liver dysfunction. And out of the box, I would say, putting her on magnesium sulfate if there is any suggestion for preeclampsia. The other thing out of the box, if there is a suggestion of preeclampsia, is giving her 20 milligrams of Lasix.
Right. So after you've done all that, now we can move to imaging.
Now we're going to move to imaging, right. This patient, if it is a severe headache, and how does one determine a severe headache? Well, it is somewhat subjective, but the fact that she is returning to us is a little bit concerning. MR, MRV, MRA can be very useful, and the radiology literature actually puts those above CT and CT angiography. I point out that even with reassuring imaging, if we're suspicious for a subarachnoid hemorrhage, we need to consider having an LP performed, a lumbar puncture performed by interventional radiology or neurology, and if she does not respond rather quickly, getting a neurologic consultation.
Okay. And so what kind of things can we do for her in the immediate setting to kind of help get rid of this headache that she's having?
Again, as she is postpartum, we're going to be ruling out preeclampsia, using the magnesium, using the Lasix, controlling the blood pressure, but if we don't feel that she's preeclamptic, acetaminophen, 1,000 milligrams orally, has been used for both tension and migraineous headaches. Indomethacin, 20 milligrams orally, is an option. Sumatriptan, 6 milligrams subcutaneously. And again, unless she has coronary syndrome or uncontrolled hypertension, we should be okay with that. The sumatriptan has been used for a number of different headache types and has shown efficacy. The headache cocktail, as many people may be familiar with, the metoclopramide, 10 milligrams IV, the prochlorperazine, 10 milligrams IV, ketorolac, 30 milligrams IV has been used. Many people will accompany this with Benadryl, 12.5, or diphenhydramine, 12.5 milligrams, to prevent any dystonic reaction. And finally, dexamethasone, 10 to 25 milligrams IV, again in the acute setting. Relieve the patient's pain.
Okay. So let's say you used those therapies and you were able to get rid of the patient's headache, but you want to prevent future headaches. If she's having has a history of migraines, what kind of options do you have for prophylaxis?
For migraine prophylaxis, probably two of the best are valproate and topiramate, and we There is level A evidence, meaning two randomized controlled trials showing efficacy with both of those agents. However, I would discourage the use of that in a young female of childbearing age because of the hazards of pregnancy. Other level A medications include metoprolol 25 milligrams BID and propranolol 20 milligrams BID for migraine prevention. Those doses can be increased if the patient's pulse and blood pressure can tolerate. Amitriptyline at night, 10 milligrams up to 50 milligrams in such doses have been useful in preventing migraines, as well as venlafaxine, 30.5 milligrams per day up to 150 milligrams per day. The amitriptyline and venlafaxine are level B evidence, but in at least one randomized study, they've been shown to be very helpful.
Okay, good. So yeah, so a good overview of headaches and migraines. Good learning points for that would be knowing the Snoop mnemonic, which I didn't know about before this, for like red flag symptoms for headaches. And then if you do get a patient in the ER, a lot of the things that they one of their go-tos, like what they call the headache cocktail, which is the Toradol, the Benadryl, and the Compazine. That tends to get rid of headaches very well for them, so they use it a lot. That's one thing to know of. And then in terms of prophylaxis, I've had a lot of success myself with my patients with amitriptyline and things like that. So it's good to know kind of not just how to treat the migraines, but also how to prevent them in the future, because if you get a patient on a good regimen, then they tend to do really well. So.
Well, thank you. Thank you for summarizing that, and thank you for joining us in Gainesville here today. I think we have time for questions. If anybody would like to ask
questions,
I have a question.
Sure. Yes, we have Dr. Catherine Patrick, and Dr. Patrick is one of our maternal-fetal medicine fellows who will soon be a perinatologist in Gainesville. And Dr. Patrick, good morning to you.
Good morning. I feel like I'm on a radio show.
Well, in many ways you are, Dr. Patrick. What is your question?
So we deal with headache a lot in triage. And I think, once we rule out some of the life-threatening conditions like preeclampsia and thrombosis and bleeds and things like that, we really are left with these patients for a good bit of time because it's difficult to get rid of their headaches. And most of our patients are not on any sort of prophylaxis for a variety of reasons. But I just want to ask about sumatriptan real quick. And I know you had mentioned on your slide to give it subcutaneously. How effective is the oral dose? And you sort of answered my question, but we had a patient that was a hypertensive patient on medications, well controlled, no concern for preeclampsia, but I was always taught that we weren't ever supposed to use those medications in hypertensive patients. So if you can just comment on that.
Yeah, thank you. I remember the second question. The oral. If somebody has a migraineous attack and they're having nausea and vomiting, then they may not be able to tolerate the oral. I think that's one of the reasons why people are so quick to give the sub-Q. The literature, believe it or not, using triptans in pregnancy is inconclusive, and there are some concerns, particularly early on, with using triptans as it is a vasoconstrictor. I suppose if somebody's normotensive in the second and third trimester and they have a classic, for them, plastic migraine attack, it could be worth trying. But again, I would be very hesitant to use that in somebody with hypertension.
Thank you.
You're welcome. We have a question from Dr. Weber, and Dr. Weber is our chief of urogynecology at UF. Dr. Weber, good morning to you.
Good morning. I recently became aware of pterygopalatine block for migraines bilaterally done percutaneously, which may be a new evolution in the treatment of acute migraine. Is that entered the the mainstream literature, or has it entered into the MFM literature for treating pregnant women?
I off the top of my head, Emily, I haven't seen that. I know that in the non-pregnant patients, we do send patients for blocks, that particular block, in all candor, I am unfamiliar with.
What are they injecting them?
Lidocaine, and they can potentiate it with steroids.
But not Botox? This
is no, not with Botox. Okay.
I think we have time for one final question. Libby King from midwife at the University of Florida. Libby King, would you proceed?
Staying on the question of migraine, so somebody is pregnant, they come in, they've been on topiramate for prophylaxis for their migraines, or going maybe into the second trimester, their migraines are starting to increase again. So, PRN, Furoset at the Tylenol and some caffeine isn't working, but can we go ahead and start them on the metoprolol for prophylaxis during pregnancy?
Yeah, Libby, I would stop the topiramate pretty quickly, only because that particular drug has been associated with clefts, and that also there's some long-term literature suggesting that there may be some neurodevelopmental problems in the infants or children exposed to that. And I would use one of these other agents, either the beta blocker or the amitriptyline, or if need be, the venlafaxine, if we can do something as prophylactic agents.
This was somebody who'd stopped. She knew to stop the topiramate. She hadn't taken, she was asking, okay, now what can I do?
Sure. So fortunately she did stop that. And I think we have some other options for her. And actually, if Dr. Wyckoff, the producer, will agree to one more question from Dr. Roussos Ross, who is our chief of gynecology at UF. Kay, it's good to have you this morning. Your question.
Bob, thank you. It's good to be here. I was wondering if you could elaborate a little bit on the magnesium as treatment for asthma exacerbation.
I would surmise that the magnesium as a smooth muscle relaxer does the same thing in the bronchioles as it does probably in the uterus. And I don't know when this got started using magnesium for asthma, but remarkably, it's been demonstrably helpful in keeping patients out of the hospital. The doses that you'll notice are 2 grams as opposed to the 6 grams that we give. But it is given over 20 minutes, I've had some favorable experience with it myself.
Right. Well, Dr. Kua and Dr. Eggerman, it's fantastic to see how these two specialties complement each other, and I look forward to doing this CME podcast in the future. So this concludes our first CME podcast on selected updates in primary care for the OBGYN, episode 1. Let's give them a warm welcome again for being here.